Okay, and that's work in collaboration with Jörg Jäckel from Heidelberg. And to give an outline, oops, one too much. I will first briefly introduce quintessence to those who don't know it by now, but I think most of us do. Then I will tell you why one should look at loop corrections or look at the fact whether these potentials are stable or not. And then I'll just briefly sketch how you calculate these loops. However, I think most of us know. I thought the astronomers would be more interested maybe in seeing how it goes. Then I will talk about scalar loops, loops by the quintessence field itself, and then I will talk about coupling the quintessence field to fermions and what the fermion loops do to the potential. And we will see that this will restrict the coupling to a large extent, and so we need to check whether graviton-induced interactions can possibly couple in such a manner. So what is quintessence? Quintessence is a kind of energy with a strange equation of state. So if you take a look at the energy density while it involves through the cosmological expansion, so that's the scale factor, that's today, that's at last scattering, here's matter radiation equality. And yeah, I've plotted some species, so that's the you may barely see it, that's the relativistic energy density that scales like a to the minus 4. This is the matter density, a to the minus 3, so at matter radiation equality, matter dominates the universe from then on. I've plotted in a cosmological constant, which is just, well, a constant during time, obviously, but which is fine-tuned such that today it would become important, but during the whole evolution of the universe it wouldn't be. So, and this solid line, that's a quintessence field, which actually in this example tracks the evolution of the background of the matter or radiation background. So it's in, well, it's in within the right order of magnitude in the energy density during the early universe. And in the late universe, it starts to dominate the energy density. So that's a possibly more natural explanation for the accelerating universe. That's what quintessence is about, and most models of quintessence are built using a scalar field, and the scalar field naturally has a potential, and the potential is, for example, an exponential potential or an inverse power law in the field. So why should I be interested in loops? I mean, if I do the cosmological evolution, if I want to do cosmological perturbation theory, then I have to know the potential. So I better have the potential right. And the potential that people use are often inspired by some more fundamental theory, for example, string theory or something like that. And so you write down your potential, but it's an effective potential, but it's effective in the sense that you've integrated out your higher energy theory. So your low energy, and with low energy I mean smaller than the Planck mass or the gut mass, your low energy fluctuations, they are still left, so you have to treat them. They can still fluctuate. And so we need to calculate these contributions. Okay, I need to caution you in the calculation, strictly speaking, all potentials are non-renormalizable, which we treat. But in the practical sense, it will turn out that some of them are renormalizable for all practical settings. Okay, we also discard the constant terms. That's the cosmological constant. Something needs to cancel that. Otherwise, it's a huge contribution, a constant contribution. So we expect some symmetry to cancel that. That's what you always hope. But the same symmetry could also cancel these loops, which we just calculate, because we don't know what it is. So maybe there's something that removes that. Keep that in mind. And actually, Susie is broken at a way too high level, way too high scale, and that's been pointed out by Kolder and Leith. Okay, calculating the loops. So in QFT, you don't have the classical action, but you take a look at the effective action. And the evolution of the field is then given by varying the effective action with respect to the field and setting this to zero. This is just exactly as with the classical action. And in order to calculate the effective action, you take a look at the generating functional for the connected endpoint functions W. That's just the logarithm of the generating functional. Then you expand the action around the classical value. And then you go over to the effective action. That's just the Legendre transform of the generating functional. For us, we factor out the space-time value because we're interested in the potential and not in the effective action. And this just gives you the one loop formula for the potential. That's just the classical potential plus 1/2 times the trace of the logarithm of the second derivatives of the action, of the classical action. So we need to specify the action. Our action looks like this. That's just square root of g multiplying. Okay, that's the Einstein part. Then we've got the kinetic term for the quintessence field, the potential of the quintessence field, and then we've got some fermion, some possibly dark matter fermion. And so that's the kinetic part, of course, of the fermion. But then we introduce a quintessence field-dependent fermion mass. In principle, you can still have a bare mass. I mean, it could be something like M fermion plus some coupling to the quintessence field. So this is a very general expression for a coupling of the quintessence field to the fermions. Is that all right? One fun? Okay, if you plug. That's the reason with the I wanted to do the I had to do the logarithm and then I could the logarithm of the square. That's, okay, if you take a look at the action, and you remember that formula, so I've got the second derivative of S2. So the second derivative of this gives me the momentum square. And this gives me v prime prime, the second derivative of the potential, of the quintessence potential. So what I get to leading order, because v prime prime is very small, that's of the order of the Hubble parameter, I get that the change in the potential induced by the scalar quintessence loop, this one here depicted, that's just the cutoff square times v prime prime. Okay. So I can take a look at all the potentials that are in the literature and check whether they are stable or not under these loops. And let's consider the exponential potential. That's been the first one around. And you immediately see that if you derive that twice with respect to the field, you get back an exponential. So that's, you're fine there. You can just redefine the prefactor of the exponential potential, and you still get the same exponential potential, so the exponential potential is form stable. Now the question is, I mean, this looks like it would be renormalizable, I mean, to this order it is. But if you go one order higher in V prime prime, which is really a very small contribution, then you find that there is an additional term that's then exponential minus 2 alpha phi, which spoils the exact renormalizability. But for all practical settings, this is a very small number. So up to the Planck scale, this thing is really renormalizable. Okay, so you can check. So this pure exponential potential, that's stable. The same is true for these Nambu-Goldstone cosine potentials because deriving twice the cosine gives you back a cosine. So you're fine there. The inverse power laws, that's something different. For example, if you start with 1 over phi as your potential and you derive it twice, then you get back 1 over phi cube. So you wonder, is this still stable? And Brax and Martin have calculated that because they were interested in the stability of both the inverse power law and the Sucre-inspired potentials. And what you find is that your contributions are high when the universe was younger than radiation and matter equality. So you should worry at that point. However, in these cases, the quintessence potential is is in the quintessence energy is completely irrelevant for the cosmological evolution. So the argument is that in the very early universe, your potential looks different. It's just more steep, but it doesn't contribute to the cosmological evolution. So you can just forget that. You wait until the cosmological evolution goes on. And after that, when the quintessence field finally is important for the evolution, this is this loop is small, and so you are fine again. Okay. And for the modified exponential potentials, for example, a polynomial multiplying the exponential potential that's been done by Albrecht and Skordis. So this is the classical potential. You've got a dip because of the polynomial that is multiplying the exponential. So this is the field in V of phi. And if you use their example, which they give in that paper, and you are mean and you use the right cutoff, then you can actually remove the dip entirely. And the feature, the new feature of the potential, which is the dip, that just goes away. But this is really mean. I mean, that's a hand-picked example. So it doesn't mean that all the modified exponentials are unstable, but you can make them unstable if you like. Okay. So in principle, I could couple my quintessence field to a fermion. And I could do that in the most general case using this M of phi, which, as I said, could be a bare mass plus a coupling. Okay, so I need to calculate the fermion loop. Oops, sorry. So that's just, sorry, I need to mention that. So this M of phi, if that is a dark matter fermion, and I assume that the dark matter fermion has the same mass as today's particles, then I should assume that it is of the order of 100 GeV, which in terms of the Planck mass is 10 to minus 16. So that's M of phi is 10 to minus 16, just because to get the right number. Okay, so the leading order or the fermion loop is given once again by a fermion cutoff square times, in that case, not the V prime prime, but this coupling or the mass term of the fermion square, just the standard expression. That's the figure that goes with that. And now we have to check. Okay, so the potential of the quintessence potential is today of the order of the critical energy density of the universe. And that's just the Friedmann equation. That's just 3 h square m square, but m is 1 in our calculation. So if you look what h is, then you find it's about 10 to minus 60 h square. So h is of the order 10 to minus 60. And if you plug that in, no h. So v is of the order h square. Yeah, okay, but that's little h. Little h is 0.65 or something. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a typo. Okay. So if you plug that in up there, you end up with 10 to minus 120 Planck masses for the critical energy density today, which is the old argument that the vacuum energy you expect from vacuum fluctuations is 10 to the minus 120 of what you get for the cosmological constant. So okay, so this is 10 to the minus 120, and rotating because it's so important. If you plug that in here, then you see this is 10 to minus 16 square. No, this is 10 to minus 16 square. This fermion cutoff you could use at the gut scale, say 10 to minus 3. So this is something like 10 to minus 40 or whatever. It doesn't matter really. But V is really, really small. So the ratio of the correction over the potential is 10 to 80. So the fermion loop entirely dominates your potential. So the potential and the coupling are coupled. You can't just pick them randomly. It's really a tight connection. You can't escape that. Okay. But you could think, okay, maybe there's a loophole, at least for the scalars. And the loophole is, what if this is not only an effective theory in the sense that I've integrated out my fundamental theory, not just down to the Planck or to the gut mass, but down to infrared, zero, this is really an effective theory. I know how it must look like. I plug that in, I do the cosmological perturbation theory, I'm right. Okay, you can do that for the scalars alone, without the fermions. Because maybe you are lucky, maybe you really get the potential right, or you can guess it right. But it's not correct if you couple to fermions. Because if you now want to say that this is an entirely effective theory, then you want to convince me that you write down the potential and the coupling at the same time, but they are connected. So you really have to guess two of the things right, because they influence each other. And all the possibilities on the market get it wrong. So for example, a valid way of coupling would be to have the exponential potential and to have an exponential coupling. So the m equals e to minus 2 beta. Yeah? Because then you've got the... Because if v is an exponential and the coupling is an exponential and you've got the exponent right, then the square of this is just the potential again. So there's one preferred family of models, so to say, that do that. But generically, this wouldn't work. So, okay. Now the question is, if I couple to fermions, then I spoil my potential. So, and the coupling needs to be really, really small to avoid that. Will gravitons maybe induce a coupling that is large enough to spoil my potential? In any case, then quintessence is lost, because you will not be able to write down the correct potential. Okay, so in principle, you could have such a situation. You could have a quintessence field depicted by these dashed lines. You could have some gravitons coupling to the fermion. The fermion makes the loop. That's what you need to calculate. So you need to calculate the effective coupling. And you do that, in principle, by replacing the Nabla slash by the tetrad multiplying the gamma matrices and here the spin connection for the fermions, and also by expanding square root of g in the graviton field. And this square root of g, because it multiplies the meta-Lagrangian, gives you couplings, because these h hit the v, the potential, and the kinetic terms in the meta-Lagrangian. So these are vertices of the h's, and in principle you get vertices out of the tetrads and all that stuff, but complicated vertices. You don't really want to calculate. Okay. So let's make a little exercise. So I assume that the coupling is small compared to the bare fermion mass. So I have the ansatz. The mass of phi is the bare fermion mass plus the coupling. And if you want to make a contribution to this coupling, a phi dependent mass contribution, then if you are a fermion and you couple to a graviton, then I don't care how your vertex looks like. This may look very, very complicated indeed. But if you want to contribute a phi-dependent part, then your graviton, when doing the loop, has to touch the quintessence field, and the only vertex there is the gravitons multiplying the potential, the scalar potential. So actually, your phi-h vertex is just proportional to the quintessence potential. And if you go back to that formula, to the delta v of the fermions, and you plug this in here, then your largest contribution, which depends on phi, is the mixed term, that's the mass times the coupling. And because the coupling is proportional to v, actually your delta potential is also proportional to v. So that's a very rough estimate or rough explanation why even if you would contribute, proportional to v, and the higher order contributions are suppressed. But we've also calculated two processes, and even the numbers, the C of phi, come out small. But even if you would worry, it would still be proportional to V, so you're fine. You don't spoil that. Okay. So that's already the conclusion. The uncoupled potentials are stable. stable for all practical purposes. And even if they are not stable, and I mean, if you can escape because you say, okay, in the early universe, they don't contribute, then for all practical purposes, yes, quintessence is stable under loop corrections. If you couple to fermions, then you have to be really, really careful. And I don't know, there are not many ways to write down something which would really be stable. That's really hand-picked stuff. And yeah, you don't have to worry about the gravitons because the gravitons, they don't spoil your potential. So that's nice. Otherwise, you would have killed quintessence. I mean, then there would be no quintessence left. Okay. Finally, the squirrel with the quintessence nut has reached the iceberg. Thanks.
The
potential is modified, and in that sense, yes, there's. If you say operators in the sense that if you make the power, if you expand the potential, if you mean that, then of course you generate more. I mean, there's an infinite number of operators because you have to expand the potential. So in some sense, you may shuffle power around in this expansion, yes, but new. It's difficult to think of that because you've got this funny exponential minus something, and then or the 1/5, and this is not what you generically have. I mean,
but at higher order, now those will also compute. I mean, you wrote down the effective potential just
on. Yeah, sure.
But I'm saying now at higher order, you would have to take into account the interaction of these.
Right. But I should explain my philosophy. My philosophy was not, I want to calculate the potential as good as I can. My philosophy was, if I get a small loop contribution, then if I get a loop contribution where I can reabsorb it, then I'm fine with the potential. If I get a large loop contribution, I don't know what the potential looks like. I didn't want to calculate how the potential will look like. I just say the loop, certainly the loop expansion breaks down because my first order loop already has a large contribution. And
but you said the exponential is stable.
Ah, yeah, okay, and you say maybe that's not modified if I do a second loop. Okay. But wait, what was the answer for that? I forgot, but there's one. I forgot the answer for that, but there's one. Thought about that, but I don't know anymore. No objections? Okay. I'm finished.